This is Dr. Allison Bailey, FACC, and Chair of the Cardiovascular Management Section Leadership Council at the American College of Cardiology. The CV Management Section is pleased to host the podcast series Practice Made Perfect, which will focus on non-clinical competencies related to leadership skills, professional identity, operational skills, and personal balance. We hope you'll join us every other week as we learn from experts in the field who will remind us that practice makes perfect.
Today on this podcast, talking about negotiation skills, helping leaders get ahead. I'd like to welcome two superstars in the cardiology world onto the podcast today. We have Kathy Biga, who's president and CEO of Cardiovascular Management of Illinois. She's also the chairman of the Board of Managers for MedAxiom and a trustee of the ACC Board. Joining Kathy is Dr. Peter L. Duffy. Dr. Duffy served as the former director of quality for the cardiovascular service line at First Health of the Carolinas Reed Heart Institute Moore Regional Hospital in Pinehurst, North Carolina. Welcome to both of you. I'd like to start off by having you tell us what you do on a daily basis in the real world. Kathy, I know you wear a lot of hats, but can you tell our listeners what you do?
Certainly, and welcome to everybody. So my day job is very interesting. I manage about 74 cardiologists in Chicago. We operate in a service line structure across 13 acute care hospitals. So my main responsibility is to keep everybody organized and to facilitate the development of our service line strategy across the suburbs and the Chicago metro region. And then my night job, as Allison mentioned, is with MedAxiom and ACC, and I love to talk about contract negotiations and physician compensation, so I'm thrilled to be here.
Wonderful, and that's a lot of hats, Kathy. And then Dr. Duffy, how about you? What does your day look like?
So I'm an interventional cardiologist, again, based in Pinehurst, North Carolina. I'm currently now doing locum tenens, traveling around the country, working at different cath labs there, both for clinical work and for quality improvement for the cath labs there. I've been fortunate to be a member of the Physicians Consortium for Performance Improvement through the AMA, worked on the panel for appropriate use criteria for PCI. I'm a member of the Interventional Council of the American College of Cardiology, and for the Society of Cardiac Angiography and Interventions, I play multiple roles. I'm current treasurer and executive committee member, and I'm chair of the cath lab survey program there. My background is that, again, I'm an interventional cardiologist, but I also hold a master's in medical management from Carnegie Mellon, where I focused on leadership and quality.
Wonderful. I saw that. That's really interesting. And you guys are both perfect speakers for our talk today. So you've both obviously been successful in navigating professional interactions, and you've negotiated many topics in your careers across a variety of platforms, inpatient, outpatient, physician, non-physician. We look forward to this discussion today about negotiation skills, and we thought we'd start with contract or job negotiations as a large topic. So, Peter, let's start with you. What are some important skills do you think for fellows coming out of fellowship when negotiating that initial job?
So the first thing really is you have to have looked at all of your options and make sure you know exactly what type of job you're looking for in order to negotiate for that job. So the key things to think about are, do you want to stay in academics? Do you want to go into private practice? And what's going to be private practice is it's going to be a large multi-specialty group or a single specialty group. And again, what would the size be? Location is very important. What's the climate of the area that you're going to be practicing in? What schools are available to you? What are the lifestyle issues? What recreational options will you be looking for? What are your housing options? And probably very importantly, if not most importantly, what does your spouse need from where you're going to relocate to when you take that job? So let's assume you've considered all those things, created your spreadsheet, looked at all the options for you, and narrowed it down to the best place. When you want to negotiate, the first thing you need to figure out is what do you have to have in your deal and what are the deal breakers? So I'd say, let's separate those two out and look at what's important to you. And what's important may be what's your compensation going to be, what's your call schedule going to be, your time off. Is it going to be CME time? Is it going to be vacation time? Are you going to have paid CME time? What's the length of your contract? And this is an important consideration these days. From an employee perspective, a longer contract really is a better contract because it locks in certain guarantees that you'll have for several years down the road, but you also want to have in that an option for early termination for yourself with 90 days or 150 days out if you decide ultimately that it's not the right situation for you to be in. If you're in a private practice, what's your time for partnership? If you're going to be in academics, what type of advancement are you looking for? What's the buy-in for partnership? What's the size of the group? How much ancillary support are you going to have? What skill sets are you going to be expected to bring to the practice there? And what skill sets do you have that's actually going to allow you to use in the practice there? So if they've already got a structural heart person doing procedures there and you want to do structural heart, that's going to be a key thing that you're going to have to negotiate up front as to what your role is going to be there. And then again, are you going to be offered benefits there, such as long-term disability, such as short-term disability, what kind of healthcare benefits and that sort of thing. So those are the things you would negotiate over, and I'm happy if you want to get into some of the negotiation techniques that you might use under those circumstances as well.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. That was a really comprehensive list of basically everything I can think of when looking for a job. And I think that time when we're coming out of fellowship tends to be a little trickier because maybe you don't have the same level of confidence you did if you were already in practice. Do you guys have any tips about how do you negotiate from a new employee standpoint?
Yeah, so I think the first important thing to look at would be what is the precedent that the group has had in the past or the employer has had in the past there. So get a contract of the person who had been hired just before you and take a look at that and see what it is that you like about that and see what it is that you might not like about that. And then be upfront with that. And if you can get that even before you're interviewed or when you're first offered the position there, before you accept the position, you might bring that up at that point to say that that's a cause for concern for you and you want to know if there's any option for some flexibility in that type of regard. So I think that's the first thing to do is to get precedent. What's the old contract? What's the newest contract that you've got to the person who stepped in before you? What does that look like? And where are you concerned that that may have some issues for you? Because again, it depends on what your leverage is. If you're going to a situation where they are having a hard time hiring someone, you've got a lot more leverage than if you're going to a situation where 10 people are competing for the job and you really want that job.
Yeah, I think Peter brings up some really good points. And for our fellows, you know, one of the issues that I think is really important is everybody's contract different? In our world, we have the same contract for everybody. And I think that's a very critical element because if you go into a group setting, you have to decide if you're going into individual silos or are you going into a group practice mentality. And that will really set the whole governance structure off as you sort of go through this. I just want to add a couple of other things specifically for our fellows in our early careers as it relates to the elements in your contract types of things. Peter did a great job. A couple of other things, especially in private practice, if you're looking at compensation, make sure you understand how the benefits are handled. Make sure that you know if your total pension comes out of your compensation. When you're employed, that's very different because obviously there's a match with the hospital, but that can make a big difference when you're doing your spreadsheet. And Peter has got great spreadsheets to make sure you're comparing apples to apples. Also, make sure what your restrictive covenant is going to be. And if you're in an employed situation, see if you are allowed to go independent or if your restriction will be in a large geographical area. Many states still uphold restrictive covenants, so very important. Also for the fellows, especially in states like Illinois and a few others, make sure you know what your medical malpractice is, whether or not you're going to have a tail, which means that the day you leave that you would have to pay sometimes 1.5 times. It can be as much as $100,000, so it's not an insignificant dollar amount for your medical malpractice. So make sure that your tail is taken care of. And the last comment I just want to make is that term is so very important because if you have a contract with a 90-day out, in essence, you actually have a compensation model that's also a 90-day compensation model. So be very careful when you're looking at that. How often are they going to relook at compensation? Because that can be very disruptive to a group. And yet trying to get long-term contracts, 5-year contracts with 5-year comp models are rare. They exist, but they're rare. So it's very important that you tie the two of those together. So I hope that helped a little bit, Allison, as we sort of look at those really important elements of a contract. And one last comment, be careful if you're sharing a contract because most contracts will have a confidential non-disclosure component to it. If a contract has that, and it gets leaked, there can be some legal ramifications to that. So be careful. Some of it is public knowledge, some of it is public information, but do be careful with the confidentiality of the contract.
Wow, I think this is really, really great advice. I can't wait to share this with my fellows and other fellows across the country that'll be listening to our podcast. Well, let's move ahead to some negotiations we may see as we move out of that initial contract and really more of an early career physician. So now you've taken that first job, you think you know your worth, or think you do, and you want to explore other options. Kathy, what do you think some tips for getting where you want to be at this point in life that may be a little different than that initial contract?
Yeah, this becomes really interesting, and I think Peter will agree as you start to look at different job opportunities. And I do think we see physicians moving more frequently than I did in the first part of my career, where oftentimes a physician would come out of fellowship and would retire in that very same practice. If I had to give one piece of advice, it would be to make sure you know what we call your BATNA, B-A-T-N-A. So that's the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Why is that important? Because you're only as good at the negotiating table as what your alternative is. If you have no alternative, you're not going to take this right up to the edge. So that would be my very first recommendation. Know before you go in what your alternative is. The other thing, as Peter mentioned, make sure you know where your line in the sand is. Do not draw consistent lines. The tide will come in and will erase your lines. So if you have a line in the sand, whatever that may be, whether it's work hours, whether it's protected reading time, whether it's a skill set, whatever that is, make sure that you completely understand it. And if you're negotiating as a group, make sure that your group understands what those lines in the sand are. Because if you're not going to abide by them, the people on the other side of that negotiating table will notice that weakness instantly, and they will attack, because this is a business discussion. This is not a clinical discussion. This is not about guidelines and the appropriateness of care. This is a business discussion.
Wow, I think that's a wonderful advice. I really like the mnemonic you use. I've never heard that before, but I'm definitely going to keep that in mind. Peter, I know you've been involved in this area as well. Do you have additional words of wisdom to add for that early career physician?
Yeah, I would agree with all that Kathy said, and just add that, you know, you really start negotiating for your second contract the day you sign your first contract. So you really need to be looking to the future even at that point there. So what was your understanding, I would ask, when you took the job about where you were going to be down the road, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the road? Did you get anything in writing at that point? And if you did, certainly keep that. Keep records of everything, though, email trails that you might have, text messages from administration, even public recognition of where they cited you for doing something to develop a program there, because they'll quickly forget that a year or two down the line when it comes to doing the negotiation with you. And let them know all along what you're expecting. Really, it shouldn't be that it's the second year of the contract that you're going in to do that negotiation. It has to be done in 30 days. Now you're creating something that they said, well, we didn't know that was what you wanted. So that's the first part. The second would be, going back to your question about what you think you're worth, you really need to be able to know what you're worth. And by doing so, you're going to look at, did you increase volume for the program by coming in there? Are there more RVUs generated by your partners because you're there? Have you increased the number or breadth of specific procedures there in terms of expanding services like heart failure or structural? And then how much is that added to the contribution margin, to the bottom line profit, to the facility because of your presence there? Have you garnered increased awards for the system? Has there been a halo effect? And then getting back to what Kathy said in terms of, you know, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement, what you really want to look at is what leverage do you have? And if you really don't think you have leverage, you need to create leverage to be able to make whoever you're negotiating with see the value of you being there and getting what it is that you want, rather than them walking away from the table as well and saying, okay, well, we'll just find you replaceable then. And lastly, when you're negotiating, really be specific about what you want. And I would say find three things that you really think you need to have and just push those constantly there. Because if you're all over the place with what your demands are, then it's going to be hard to have them met. And that means things like, did you want an increase in income? Do you want more time off? Do you need more ancillary support? Do you need more time for research? Is it the time to partnership? Is it a title that you need? Is it office space? Any of those kinds of things, figure out what it is that you are looking for there and be very specific when you're negotiating with that system to be clear about what it is that's going to make you happy.
That one comment about data is so very important because so often physicians will go to the table and not have their data. So there's enough publicly reported data as it relates to compensation, geographical, subspecialization. Very important to understand the survey data because that's what the other side of the table will be looking at. So whether you're using Sullivan-Cotter or MGMA or MedAxiom or AMA, make sure that you have recent data and set your expectations realistically. Because if you don't understand your geographical market, as Peter mentioned, you're going to put yourself on the defensive, and that's not where you want to be.
No, that's right. And I really liked Peter's advice about prospectively collecting your volumes and your halo effect, because it's so much easier if you do it going forward than trying to retrospectively get that data. And you may be in an organization that doesn't even collect that data appropriately.
Right. Correct. So documentation is everything in these negotiations, as Kathy said. So just as it's important in your medical record, it's going to be important in your negotiation. The other thing I would add here, and we got a lot of pushback from this, and we did negotiate with our system too, was this phrase that's a great idea, but the lawyers won't allow it. You've got to push back against that one and have your own attorneys looking at what it is that they're looking at, because organizations tend to be very risk averse, and some of these guidelines that are out there are very vague, and their lawyers are going to interpret those in the strictest way that protects the system as best possible, even if it goes against you. But there may be a lot of leeway that's available there that they're simply not willing to offer to you. And if you have your own attorney looking at that, they can push back on that and say, actually, it's not. You're saying you can't do it, but that's just an opinion. That's not reality. So I think that's an important factor that comes up all the time, because you'll get them to agree, but they'll say, oh, but the attorney said we can't do that.
Yeah. I think that is so critically important, especially when you're talking, and Peter, you did talk about your support staff, whether you're in your initial negotiations, not so much, but certainly as Allison has mentioned, in this mid-career and even in your late career component, the fallacies that exist amongst the legal community, you need to make sure that you really understand it. Make sure that you know or know somebody who can help you. Again, we're not expecting physicians to be experts in negotiation necessarily, but there are a lot of consultants and attorneys that will help you both in the legal world and the fair market value world. Because remember, there's two elements that you must pass as you're looking at physician compensation. One of those is fair market value. And fair market value, I have seen go from $40 a work RVU to $75 a work RVU. That's a pretty big range. So understanding how fair market value is determined is critically important. Choosing the firm that's going to give that fair market value opinion is very important, and it can be done jointly. And then the second element that's very important to remember is commercial reasonableness. And especially for mid-career, if there's one cautionary note I'd want to put out in our podcast today, is that you do have to pay attention to commercial reasonableness. And I'll give you a quick example. If you're a physician that generates 10,000 work RVUs and you're paid $350,000 in your private practice, and the hospital offers you $500,000 to join them as an employed physician with the expectation that you'll continue to generate 10,000 work RVUs, that may not be deemed as commercial reasonableness. It may not be deemed that you can get a $150,000 or $200,000 salary increase for doing the same amount of work. What that may be construed as is perhaps paying for referrals. This is why you need to be very careful and have both legal and or a commercial reasonableness fair market value help as you're negotiating. I see that more so in that mid-career neck of the woods. So I would just make sure that our audience pays attention to that.
I think that's very true. And do you guys have any specific tips to a mid-career physician who may want to change directions? So they've been more clinically active, and now they want to either have more time, they want to, you know, trade their clinical activities for time, or they want a new directorship. Anything special there?
Well, I think what I'm seeing, and I'd be interested to see what Peter's saying, is we as systems are in desperate need of physician leadership. This gets really complicated because oftentimes a physician can make more money in a mid-career situation in the clinical world than they can in the administrative world. So what does that look like as physicians may want to transition either partial clinic, partial administrative, or perhaps all administrative? So this is another area where I would strongly suggest that you gather your data, as Peter mentioned. I would strongly suggest that you participate in the MedAxiom meetings and the ACC Summit, where we pull people together on these very topics. How do you make that transition, and what is appropriate compensation for those transitions? I would say your best friend in that are two. Number one, networking, so you understand what the market looks like for our physician leaders. And number two, back to Peter's point, make sure you keep your own repertoire. What have you done? What programs have you developed? Where's your leadership skill? You don't necessarily have to have an MBA. I know there'll be this ongoing debate, in my opinion, as to whether or not after MD or DO, do we need MBAs after our physician's name? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I'd be interested to hear what Peter thinks about that.
Yeah, I agree, Kathy. I think practical experience is critical to that. You can have an MBA and still not be able to do the job, or you could have great, great administrative skills simply because that's the world you grew up in. I think, again, CV Summit, as you mentioned, ACC CV Summit, which is held January or February each year, is important, and I would certainly like to see more cardiologists involved from an administrative standpoint there who want to be administrators, who want to learn those skills. MedAxiom has excellent programs as well, and then there's a group called the American Academy for Physician Leadership. It used to be called the American College of Physician Executives, which has excellent courses and is just developed just for physicians to look at leadership skills, quality, and what they need to do to make an impact. The key thing here is that all these programs are taking place, all these decisions are being made around us by people who are not us, and that does affect us. And so, you know, there's a bunch of different little phrases out there, like if you're not taking part, you're going to be taken apart, or if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. But really, all of those are true. And we as cardiologists bear a responsibility for our patients and for ourselves to get involved in this, to make the right decisions, because the people who are making the decisions are not necessarily malicious in the decision-making that they're making, but many times they're misinformed or don't understand the true nature of the issue we're dealing with. And if we're there and can advocate effectively for our profession, that's going to be much more important to affect our lives, our patients' lives, and our colleagues' lives going down the road.
And that's why we're all here, I think. So this is great information. We've talked about early and mid-career strategies for kind of getting ahead and getting to where the point in our career we want to be. Now let's focus on that late career or our potential wind-down period. A lot of people change their priorities during this time and may be interested in different options than they were 10 or even 5 years ago. What advice do you have at this point in a career?
This takes us back to the beginning of the podcast for new physicians. The day after you start, probably you don't want to do this during the interview process, but we can see what Peter thinks. But the day after you start, please make sure that you know what the call wind down and retirement plan in writing is in your organization. It is the one thing of the most angst that I see as it relates both to our physicians in the twilight or in their next phase of their career, and also what will cause the most angst to the mid-career, early career, and fellows if they're joining someone. It is, in my opinion, one of the most important elements of compensation design is to make sure that there's a mechanism in place specifically that values call, that specifically identifies when you can go into call wind down at a certain age, after being with the group 20 years. You know, when you've seen one, you've seen one. So there's lots of different ways that you can do that. But to make sure that, especially if you're going into a small group or three or four, and a week after you start, the senior physician says, "Hi, I'm not taking call anymore. I'm so glad you're here. Hot dig, you're on call every other night." You know, so very, very important that you have that element in place. And for our senior physicians, it will also protect you. I will just tell you quickly, the elements that I see in the most successful is number one, identifying the number of years with the practice and or an age. Number two, identifying the value of call. So you'd have to take your compensation plan and make sure you have a mechanism for how you value call. Across the country, we are still seeing between 30 and 40% of total compensation is in call. Why is that important? Because if I decide to come off call completely, I should expect to take a 30 to 40% drop in compensation. So very, very important. Then the next piece is, how long can you stay off call? Can you stay off call for 10 or 15 years while everybody else is, you know, either struggling to cover your call or whatever? And are you leaving enough room for new physicians to join the practice? So obviously a topic I'm passionate about, because so many programs just fail to negotiate that at the early stages. Peter, what have you seen?
Yeah, so I mean, those are great points there. And I think you've outlined, you know, what it's like if it's been thought about and it's been codified and everybody understands it going in. But as you mentioned, oftentimes that's simply not the case. So I think the first thing for the physician going into those changing late career years is to recognize that it's not going to be changed for him or her, it's also going to be changed for the practice itself. So this is something an individual needs to really start to think about at least 5 years before they really want to put it into effect, and be talking about it at least 2 or 3 years before they would be putting it into effect, and then really getting down to negotiating what it would be at least a year before it goes into effect. And the main thing to consider, as you mentioned, is the decrease in call. How are you going to offset that? So one way to do that might be to say, okay, but I'm going to spend all my time now in the office. I'm simply not going to go to the hospital. That will relieve some of you guys who want to be in the hospital more, or gals want to be in the hospital more, to be able to do more procedures, stay over there and see more patients. The advantage of the practice will be, we'll have some walk-ins come in now. We'll have a transition clinic here. We might even have Saturday office hours that I'll be willing to do. So how do you balance what the group's needs are to what your needs are? And maybe that's one of the things that the group does need there. Another option would be to see, could you split actually what it is that you're doing with another individual? And there's one practice I know where there were two interventional cardiologists who made up one FTE. They worked pretty much 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and we're very happy with that arrangement there under that circumstance. So the group essentially had one FTE, but two people fulfilling that position there. So I'd say the critical thing would be, if you're going to negotiate with a group, find out what it is they need to meet your priorities, and then do what you can to try to help them meet your priorities, as long as it goes within what it is your structure is going to be. And if it means helping them recruit either another physician or ancillary personnel to be able to fulfill the role that you are playing, then I think that's important for you to do. And it's also important for you to clearly state up front what would be the ideal situation for you, because what you don't really want to have is where the group feels it's given in a lot to you, and you walk away from that saying, well, that's not really what I wanted in the first place, and nobody's really happy, and it stressed the system, and it didn't make change in a positive direction.
Wow, I think those are lots of great sort of non-traditional options that people may not think about, and, you know, really realizing that your practice is flexible and you just have to find the right place. Well, I want to thank you both so much for your time here on the Practice Made Perfect podcast and helping us learn how to negotiate more successfully during different portions of our career. I know I've learned a lot of valuable skills, and I'm certain our listeners have it as well. I look forward to talking with you both again, and thank you.
This is Dr. Allison Bailey, FACC. Thanks for joining us today, and please be sure to join us online at acc.org or on iTunes and Google Play to subscribe to Practice Made Perfect. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue our series and keep the conversation going on our new online community, Member Hub, to discuss these topics and any top-of-mind practice issues. Catch you next time to discuss more on how practice really does make perfect.